Welcome to the 20 Things Adoption Podcast with your host, adoption author Sherry Eldridge. Adoptive parents will find hope here, hope that strained relationships with their adopted children can heal.
We're going to have an author here that I think you're going to really, really enjoy. Her name is Carrie Williams, and I just discovered her a few weeks ago by finding some of her books and her writing and her social media and so on. And so I talked her into doing a podcast with me today, and I'm so thrilled. She is an award-winning author and advocate for caregivers of children with reactive attachment disorder. She's a very experienced foster and adoptive parent. She spent two decades navigating the child and mental health systems with her children and on behalf of her children. What an advocate she is. And she's very passionate. To this day, I think her passion is growing, that she wants to get out resources for parents who just don't know what to do. They're just really stuck and they're in so much pain. First of all, I want to introduce you to Carrie and ask you, Carrie, if you would just tell us your story. Tell us how you became an adoptive and or foster mom.
Thank you for having me. So I adopted two kids out of foster care in Florida around 2005. And I had been a foster parent before as a single person. Later on, after I got married, I again was a foster parent. So it was really like a long-time dream of mine to adopt kids out of foster care. So the caseworkers approached us, asked if we'd be willing to consider adopting these two children. And it was a boy and a girl. Devin was 3 and Kayla was 2 at the time. And of course, we were told that they had been a good foster home since birth. They were perfect. They had no issues. We really jumped in heart first. Now, they came to our house and they had those typical kind of issues that come with a lot of foster kids. They had potty issues. They had food issues. They used to scream like I had never heard kids scream before for no reason. In fact, at one point we had our neighbor knocking on the door saying that he was going to call the police on us because he thought for sure we must be abusing them. But it was that whole thing that happens when you're neglected as a child. And the thing is, none of these behaviors really were warning signs for me or flags, because for anybody who's adopted out of foster care or been a foster parent, those behaviors are very normalized. They tell us this is how kids are going to behave. They're going to have these types of behaviors from the trauma they've endured, from the neglect, the abuse. And I had been a foster parent for years, so I thought this is fine. Once we get through the adoption and they start feeling stable and they have the love of our home, everything is going to be fine. And I also, they were 3 and 2. I had a 2-year-old biological child also. So I was like, I know how to take care of kids this age. You know, I've got this, right? So we adopted, and my daughter, Kayla, she actually did acclimate to our family over time. It took a lot of years. She has some attachment issues, but I like to say how she used to love animals more than people. She was very attached to animals. And so we really leaned into that, and she eventually was able to transfer that affection and that attachment to people. So we were able to do things like get her an IEP. I got her put on ADHD medications, and that's often a misdiagnosis for kids with RAD. But for her, it was absolutely a good diagnosis. And I know that because the medication immediately worked. So I knew that was a solution. So she was able to work through a very significant learning delay in math. And so over time, it took time. It wasn't easy, but we definitely were able to use a lot of kind of interventions in our home to help her, some therapy, different things like that. And that was very successful. But with my son, her brother, Devin, things did not get better. When he first came to our home, he would like pull his poop out of the toilet and play with it. He would pee all over in random places. He would spit in my face. And over time, this behavior, it just got worse and worse and worse. And I was just struggling trying to figure out what to do. I tried everything. I tried behavior modification. We tried timeouts. We tried everything. And I remember originally, and I think this is what's kind of disconcerting for a lot of parents with kids who don't know what they're dealing with, I felt like there was a mental kind of disconnect with him. And so I would often say, like, I could take my daughter and his sister and my biological son. I could put all 3 of them in timeout. And the other 2 kids would learn from that. They'd event because behavior modification worked with them. But with him, it was like, it didn't make any difference. He would just continue to do the same behavior. And so I actually thought that he wasn't understanding And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And by the time he was in kindergarten, he was pulling his door off the hinges. He was putting holes in the wall. He was chasing his siblings with bats. He was becoming violent in his behaviors. And he was having these really horrific tantrums, which I later learned were actually rages. But his behavior was very unmanageable. And I was trying to get help. I went and saw a therapist. We went and got him some speech therapy. We tried medications. We did a bunch of different things. Nothing was working. And what people kept saying to me is, you need to love him more. You need to hug him more. And of course, that was crushing me because I already knew that. I was already like, what's wrong with me? Why can't I parent this kid? Why don't I love him enough? What's wrong with me? And I was already like in this point of real depression and despair, feeling like this was all my fault. I didn't know what was wrong. Why I couldn't fix it.
Condemning yourself, right?
Yes, yes. And so that just compounded the problem that people were, you know, saying, this is all your fault. The truth is, I did become a bad mom because this type of behavior, I think it's the fact that the behavior is relentless. You have no break day after day after day, year after year. We're just humans. We're just humans. You know, I did things I regret. I wasn't as loving as I should have been. I wasn't as patient, as kind. But that's because I was in a situation that I couldn't manage. And when parents are in that situation, this is what I like to tell parents is that's when you go get yourself some help. That's when you go get yours some interventions, because if it's not good for you, it's not good for your child either. You're not creating a good environment for them.
Do many of them have like PTSD or compassion fatigue, the parents, from trying so hard?
Oh, yes, definitely. So I was eventually diagnosed with PTSD and also some depression, and I was put on an antidepressant, which really helped me. Let me go back in my story a little bit, and then I'll get to that point. But our turning point came when my son was 8 or 9 years old, and he pushed my littlest one, who now was 4, down the stairs from the top of the stairs. And I was sitting at the bottom of the stairs and looking up and thinking, oh my God, this is dangerous. Somebody could actually get killed or seriously hurt. I was way beyond my the point of where I should have been getting help. But when you're in it, it's very hard to recognize that because you're so busy trying to fix it. But that was when I really, it came together for me. I've got to get help. And so we went in through the mental health ER, which is what a lot of parents do. He had Medicaid because he's an adopted foster child. And we went there multiple times. Eventually, we got some in-home treatment. And when the first time, he didn't show his behaviors to many people, but when he finally showed one of these rages to one of the workers, they immediately said to me, he needs to be out of your home. He needs to be in RTF. You can't keep him safe. He's not safe here.
What's RTF?
Residential treatment facility, where the kids live and they get treatment. And so he went there and I really thought he was going to return home. And so I went to a therapist for myself at that point. And I went in and I was just crying. And I said, something is wrong with me. Why am I not able to parent this child? Why don't I love him? Why is this happening? And she's the one, to get back to what you were asking me about, she's the one who diagnosed me with PTSD and encouraged me to get on antidepressant, which I like to say because that can help a lot of moms out there to, you know, talk to your doctor. It may be something like that. They can help you get through that period. So that really helped me. She also explained to me, she said, it's not reasonable to expect a parent to immediately love an adopted child. That takes time. It takes time to attach, like with my daughter, right? My other adopted child, I was able to attach to her. I was braiding her hair. I was, you know, doing all these things with her. You know, she would be scared and she'd come sleep in my bed and we were able to build this attachment. But my son, he was spitting in my face, literally. And she said, we don't like to talk about domestic violence with kids, but it's a very similar idea where it's very hard for you to have this natural love feeling for someone who's treating you like that persistently. And so she helped me not realize I still felt a lot of guilt from my part in not being able to be the parent he needed, but it helped me understand how I got to that place and that the system is not setting up parents for success. They're not preparing you for this and providing you with the resources and support that you need to be successful.
That's right. Absolutely. Did you get any kind of preparation, Carrie, before? I mean, did they say to you, your child may rage or he may have be violent or whatever? No, they don't tell you that, do they?
They don't. So we went through the foster parenting classes, which is what you do if you adopt out of foster care. And so they did tell us that these kids would have these behaviors. And what they liked to tell us was they might have junk behaviors. Right? So they might curse at you or they might throw their toys. And the best thing to do is ignore it. And what they don't understand is that might work for a lot of kids, But for kids who are on this extreme spectrum of reactive attachment disorder, their behavior can actually be dangerous and violent, and you cannot ignore it. That is not an option, because they'll either hurt themselves, hurt their siblings, hurt you, destroy property. And so they don't give you the solution to that. They just pretend that that's like, can't possibly happen. And I used to say to these facilities that he's in, because my son was in 18 facilities over 8 years. He never returned home. He turned 18 in the facilities. I used to ask them, what am I supposed to do when he's being violent? Because when he was in the facilities, there would be adult men, there would be staff people, they would restrain him, they would give him shots of things to calm him down. None of that is a good solution, but that was the best they had. And I can't do that at home. So I've never really found a solution. And so what I often tell parents is, if you're in the position where you're starting to restrain your child because they're so out of control, you have to physically restrain them, that's when you need to be looking for out-of-home care, because you cannot do that safely in your home.
If a situation, a crisis happened like that, they would go to the emergency room of the psychiatric hospital. Is that the deal?
When he was in the facilities?
Yeah. How do you progress with getting him into the residential care? Does he have to go through the hospital first and get a diagnosis and so on?
Yeah, it's really, really hard to get your kids into care. I had Medicaid. I was fortunate because he was an adopted foster kid. I think people who adopt internationally especially have a hard time because they're using private insurance. I was fortunate because I did have Medicaid. And someone gave me some advice early on, and they said, just keep going to the mental health ER, because eventually the insurance company will decide they don't want to keep paying for that. And of course, just doing that's very hard, right? Because I'm driving with my son who's 10 years old, and he's trying to climb out the window of the car, or he's kicking the headrest. People don't think about the logistics of that and how we need help. So I had an older son. He used to help me a lot. He would sometimes have to like hold him like in a hug on the way to that. To get us to the hospital. And then my son would get to the hospital, and this is a very common story, but he acted amazing. His behavior was fantastic the whole time he was there. And that, you know, and the staff would be like, your son is lovely. He's so wonderful. We hope you had time to calm down while he was here.
Oh my goodness. Oh.
But I continued to bring
ignorance.
Him until they were willing to pay for him to get in-home care, which is where they finally saw the behaviors, and then they put him in RTF. Now, once you get him in RTF, at least where I am, Medicaid tries to send him home every 6 months.
Oh, so what do you do then? You have to do the same thing?
Well, so at first I wanted him to come home. I was actively trying to work with the therapist. It took me about 2 years to get myself to the point where I was, you know, in therapy and on medication. He was out of my home, to get myself to the point where I was in a good place to deal with him. And I know a lot of parents don't want to talk about it. It's embarrassing. You feel bad. Like, what's wrong with you? That's the truth. That's where this takes us. So it took me 2 years to get to a point where I felt like those feelings of affection towards him, like I felt positive towards him. In the meantime, though, his behavior was getting worse and worse. He was in these facilities. He stabbed a girl in the back of the head with a pencil. He broke a woman's thumb, and he would have suicidal ideation, you know, wrapping things around his neck. And they used to say, well, he's not trying to kill himself, but it didn't matter, because if he was at my house, what if I didn't see him? I didn't have cameras in my home. I didn't have staff to watch him 24/7. And I also was watching my other children. Their lives were getting so much better because, and this is my biggest regret, is I did not realize what I was exposing my other kids to. And my birth son, who I had after I did the adoption, he was even exposed in utero. And it's very similar to being exposed to domestic violence, in my opinion, because those kids, they live with, am I going to get to go to soccer practice today? I don't know what today's going to bring. Is my mom going to help me with homework? Is there going to be a screaming scene before I go to school? And I'm feeling terrible and uncertain. So my kids were exposed to that for years. So once my other son, my adopted son, Devin, was in the facility, even though he wasn't getting better, I had to make this terrible choice to leave him there, because I knew I could help my other children, and I could not expose them to that level of danger and abuse anymore. And some parents reach this point, and it's a horrible, horrible choice to make. But that's when I started really dedicating myself to, how do I keep him safely in the facility? Because that's the best option for our whole family at that point.
Oh my goodness. Is there any hope for these kids? I mean, for Devin,
for kids on the mild end of the spectrum, like my daughter, I think there's a lot of hope. I think that there are a lot of treatments that can work in interventions. As you go up on the scale, kind of, because, you know, RAD is a spectrum disorder. And as you go up, I think that there is much less hope. And I think there could be hope. I think it's not parents' fault. I think it's the system's fault because they don't have interventions for these kids. They don't have treatments. That's one of the things that I try to advocate for, is that we need to look at getting viable solutions. And without those, parents have to often make these really difficult decisions that just, you know, aren't good for anyone. They're not good for the family. They're not good for that child.
I can't imagine how painful that is. My heart just goes out to you and to these parents. It's so hard. Well, you know, Carrie, how prevalent is RAD, reactive attachment disorder? I mean, like, how many families in the U.S. do you think are parenting children with reactive attachment disorder?
Well, they say that it's rare, which is true in the general population. But when you look at kids who've been adopted or kids who've spent time in foster care, it's much, much more common. And I've seen estimates as high as 30 or 40% of those kids. Now, not all of those kids are on the severe end of the spectrum. And that's really important for parents to not jump to the conclusion that their children cannot be helped with interventions in their home and different treatments, because many, many of these children can. I think the key is for that is getting to the families early. So I do think that had I had better training, had I known about what to expect and where to get help, I could not have fixed my son. I can't cure RAD, but I could have made it better. I could have made better choices. I could have done things differently if I had known better. And so I think that right now, that's because we can't obviously create the interventions, right? You and I. But what you and I can do as advocates is we can try to get to these parents early and say, let's help your child where they're three, not when they're nine, like my child, and when they're getting to the point where they're dangerous.
Yes, absolutely. Oh my goodness. Tell us about your books and your speaking. And I love the title of your one book, He Spit in My Coffee, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. That's an attention getter.
Yes. So the first book I wrote was the little small guidebook to RAD. And basically what that is everything I wish I had known. And this is kind of getting back to what we talked about getting to parents early. You know, had I known, I didn't know what a RTF was or a group home or even a mental health hospital. I mean, I didn't even know what to Google for help. So the whole idea behind that, it's a very small book, but it just is, here's the things you really need to know. And this is kind of the unvarnished truth, non-emotional, just here it is. Let me help you, you know, on your journey forward. The second book, The Butt He Spit in My Coffee, I set out to write sort of a traditional nonfiction book. And then I realized that that wasn't going to make a difference, because what we always say as parents of kids with RAD is you do not understand until you live it yourself. And so I thought, well, what I can do is I can write my story like a novel so that you can hand it to your mother and your mother can read the book. And as a reader, you can get involved in the story and you can live it yourself and walk through it and have that experience. And so I wrote it that way. In particular, it really reads just like a fictional book, that they can read the story and you can give it to your mother, your therapist, your teacher, and it can start to build those bridges. And I've heard so many stories, people saying, I gave this to my mother and now she came and apologized to me and she's helping me. Somebody gave it to caseworkers. Parents of RAD kids read it. And I also hear from them that it's very validating to them. They're like, I finally feel seen and heard. Somebody knows my story. So that's another power of the book. But the purpose that I really wrote it for was as a way for us to build our support systems by saying, here, read this book so you can understand what my life is really like.
Oh, that's wonderful. Can you tell us about your career in the adoption field?
A little bit of speaking. I've been on NPR and Court TV, and I've written some articles. And I also have been speaking every year. I'm going to be speaking again next month at the RAD Advocates Conference. And just to put a little plug in for that conference, the reason I really appreciate it is it's not just a conference where you go and you learn a bunch of information. It's actually a guided experience where they guide you through coming up with a plan so that when you go home, you have a plan, whether that plan is I'm going to get certain help in the home, or I think I might need to look at relinquishment, or I might need to look at a place at home. But it's actually a guided experience where you work through a workbook and listen to speakers like me, and you come up home with a plan. And so that's why I really think that's a fantastic conference. And it's through RAD Advocates.
That is wonderful. Yes, I would encourage parents to go to that. I don't know if I mentioned to you, but I'm writing a book right now. It's going to be my 9th book, and it's going to be what moms can do when their kids reject their love, and sometimes them. I interviewed 50 moms for this. Yeah, so what would you say to moms who are hurting so bad? I mean, the self-condemnation is really a plague, isn't it? I mean, you can't get rid of that as a mom. You think you can't meet the needs of your special needs child, and it must be something that makes your parenting very ineffective. Isn't that kind of the mindset?
It is. And I think that's a great book topic. I'm sure you will be talking about things you can do to work with your children. But the other component of that is what you're talking about is you have to work with yourself because of the way, how can you deal with it? How can you build your own resiliency? How can you take care of yourself? How can you build your support system? And how can you begin to understand your journey through this and try to let go of some of that guilt and that, you know, you did the best you could with what you had and what you knew at the time. You know, for the people who've read my book, they know way more about me than they should because I try to be really honest because I think one of the problems why we're not getting help is because it's embarrassing and shameful, right? And so we don't want to tell therapists that and talk to people. We've got to start talking about that and saying, this is how much it breaks a mother. We need help too, as much as our kids.
It has to be about self-care because that's the last thing you do, right?
Yes.
You're over in overdrive for your child. I believe that I had reactive attachment disorder as a young child because I was conceived not in a good situation, that, you know, trauma in the womb, trauma after with a 10 days in an incubator. My mom, I mean, she got a surprise when she tried to hold me. I screamed bloody murder. I didn't want anything to do with her. So it was almost like being shot out of a cannon. That's the way I describe it, to have that kind of pain from trauma. I just really tune into what you're doing. And when you posted on social media that there's an unspoken, tragic situation that's happening in the adoption and fostering world, and this is it. People don't know about it. They don't know how to help people. You know, especially what about the faith community? I mean, are you a believer and how does the church play in there? Is there understanding there currently?
When I fostered and adopted, I was living in Florida at the time. And so I was attending a huge mega church with, you know, thousands and thousands of people. And they had a big adoption and foster care ministry. And that's actually who I fostered through and adopted through. And I was very supported during that whole fostering experience. Now, once my child started acting up and acting out these behaviors, I met a very common response, which is, well, you need to spank them and pray for them. And those solutions don't work with kids, especially on the severe end of reactive attachment disorder. I mean, to be honest, I got to the point where I couldn't go to church anymore because I was so broken and there was just nothing anymore there for me. So I am a person of faith, but it caused me to not want to be part of the church. And I think a lot of people have this experience. And again, that's part of like educating people on what we're dealing with here. This is not normal. I'm sad. Like what you just said, like it feels like being shot out of a cannon, trying to really understand what that's like for the child and how severe it is and how it actually changes how their whole internal sense of themselves. And then looking at the parents and saying, okay, we understand what you're dealing with. This is really severe and significant. Let us offer you actual help. And if they can't offer answers, they can offer other things, right? They can offer you meals. They can offer you babysitting. They can just offer you I'll listen to you without telling you you're wrong and, you know, all this stuff, right? There's a lot that the faith community can do. And I really believe the faith community, it just hugely impactful in the adoption and faith arena. I mean, so many people are adopting through churches and that's great. And so they've got to come up to speed on this issue so that they can really help these families be successful because it's really breaking families apart. And kids, right? The kids, you look at the kids, you know, I talk a lot about the parents and the effect on the parents, but you look at the children, like my son, who turns 18 without a high school diploma, without ever having played sports, without going to prom, without having job experience, with criminal record, all these things. I mean, those children, their lives are being destroyed and they're not getting childhoods because of this.
So, I mean, how could a church begin to provide a safe place for these parents or for a single mom or whoever adopts or fosters? Would it be small group? What if the pastor started to pray for? I mean, if someone like you could educate the staff about what that's like so that they could pray for these parents so that they're not hidden. It's so shameful. It needs to be brought out in the open because I think, Carrie, it's one of the tenderest wounds in the world of adoption. Nobody wants to talk about it. So small groups, I mean, moms need one another, right? Parents need one another.
That's the thing. I know when I realized when my son finally got diagnosed, and I at the time read Nancy Thomas's book, which was pretty much the book out there at the time about this. And it really changed my life, not because it fixed anything. It didn't fix a thing, but because I wasn't alone anymore. Fundamentally, it was not my fault and I wasn't alone. And I find that parents, you know, they're getting so much support from online support groups. And the reason they're doing that, there's thousands of them. It's because that is the only place they can go where they feel heard and not judged and understood. And I try on my Facebook page to be very supportive of parents and to kind of bring out their feelings. This is how we're feeling. It's okay that we're feeling this way. That's normal. And so I think if we can transfer that to your question about faith groups and churches and small groups, if we can transfer that to in-person small groups for parents where you're providing babysitting and these mothers, because primarily this affects mothers, where they can actually get together physically and they can feel that support, because that will not fix this problem of RAD. We need our mental health system to step up for that. But what it can do is it can help these parents survive, get through this, better outcomes for the kids just because the mom is being supported.
Right. So that the mom can have peace within, even though chaos reigns in the home, they can be confident at peace.
Right. And when you're dealing with chaos, if you're depressed and you're feeling completely despair as you're going through chaos, you're not going to respond as well as you could if you feel like a little healthier for yourself. So again, it doesn't fix the problem, but it can make it better. And I think at this point, we have to look for those small wins because there aren't the big wins, especially for the kids on the severe end of the spectrum. So we really do have to look at that and say, that's great success, right? That I felt good enough. I like to talk about when I speak at the conference I speak at, I talk about how with my son, who's now 22, I text message with him and I'll send him like a little meme or I'll send him a picture of a cat. And he responds back and laughs and says it's funny or whatever. And most people would say, gosh, that's terrible. Like you have no relationship with your son. But to me, that's really successful because I feel good about sending it to him. I'm like, oh, he would like this. And he has responded back positively. And if that's the best I can get, that is still something to feel good about. And I think we have to reset our expectations a little bit to try to like embrace some of those successes. And, you know, if I were to text message him and ask him about his job or where he's living, things might get ugly. So I don't do that. And that's, we have to make those choices.
I love that. Oh, that is a true relationship with them. I think that's beautiful. We talked previously before we came online that you've gotten kind of a hard time from adoptees about this. And that breaks my heart because we adoptees have to do our own hard work so that we can not be hateful and unloving. Anger is okay. It's the hate that proves that we need to be healed. Fellow adoptees, don't you dare pounce on Carrie. I won't let you. I think she's a super mom, and I'm just so thrilled to have her here. And is there anything else you want to say before we close, Carrie?
Well, I definitely think, you know, the parents that I work with and who will listen to this when I share, they're going to want to know, you're saying that you had RAD as a child. How did you heal? What did that look like for you? And as someone who had it, what would you recommend to parents?
Yes. Well, I believe I just healed a few years ago. I had a healing of memories and someone in my current life hurt me in a way I didn't deserve. And through a little bit of study, I realized that I had some inner work to do. And so I started going down the path. I call it the path of forgiveness. because that's the only faculty that can reverse pain and bring you to a point of health. And so I did that. And, you know, now I was really a rascal kid. I gave my mom a very hard time and I didn't like her even until the last time I talked with her. And I had a lot of guilt from that and everything. I think what's exciting now, Carrie, is that current research has proven that many people who have been traumatized, their brains can heal. And I believe I'm one of the lucky ones. I think your Devin shows healing too, with the way he's communicating with you. I think that's just beautiful. So that's how it happened with me. And I'm going to share that with the moms in my book.
I think that's really fantastic because those are the voices that we need talking about this, people who've actually lived through it and speak from their own experience. I think that's really important.
Yeah, it affected every area of my life. Being a mother, I have two children. So being a mother, it affected that, affected my marriage. Even though, you know, we've been married 58 years, my husband has lived through a lot with me and vice versa. You know, it's always that way in a marriage, but I'm so happy that I've received this healing and that I am free to just enjoy people and love and everything else. So I want to get that message out. That's what it's going to be all about.
I think that's fantastic. That's great.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you to all of you who listened to us and shared this podcast with people on your social media. Go to my podcast, 20 Things Adoption is the name of the podcast this will be on. You can get it on any of the podcast channels. So come use this as an educational tool in your schools, in your church, in your neighborhood, in your family. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the 20 Things Adoption podcast. If you can think of friends or family that would benefit from this information, feel free to share. See you next time.